This case is A21-0604, the state of Minnesota versus Larry Dwayne Lucas Jr.
Good morning. I'm going to have a few opening comments before we begin. Thank you, first of all, for being willing to participate remotely. And we appreciate all of the effort that you've made to make sure that your connections are working and that you've got all the equipment that you need to make this go smoothly. On that point, we understand from time to time there will be interruptions or maybe technical difficulties. If something does happen, let us know right away. We'll do everything we can to accommodate that and to ensure you have all the time to which you're entitled to argue before this court today. Also, I'll ask that you, when you're not speaking, that you mute yourselves. And I'll note that only the attorneys and the judges are able to share their screens or be visible and participate in the hearings today. So everybody else is able to observe, but that they are not able to do anything beyond that. I also ask that you note your name and the party that you represent before you begin. And that way, the audio recording that we are making is clear on who's speaking on behalf of whom. And that is the only permitted recording that we don't permit any other recordings beyond that one. And with that, why don't we go ahead and begin? Mr. Butler.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant Larry Lucas. This court must reverse Mr. Lucas's conviction, our convictions, for any of the three reasons in our brief. I'd like to discuss the first two today, the speedy trial issue and the expert testimony issue. I'd like to highlight three key things about the speedy trial issue. The first is the timing. This case and this delay occurred at a time when the Minnesota Supreme Court was allowing jury trials to be held. And so that differentiates this case from all of the cases cited in respondent's brief, and it differentiates the case from this court's decision in Jackson and from the decision in State versus Page, which is pending before the Minnesota Supreme Court. In those cases, those trials were held during a time when the Supreme Court, I'm sorry, those delays happened when the Supreme Court had prohibited jury trials. That was not the case here. The second key finding, or key thing I want to highlight, is that the trial judge, the original trial judge, Judge Halverson, declined expressly to find that the continuance in this case was supported by good cause. If you look at page 20 of the transcript of the November 30th, 2020 hearing, the prosecutor asked the judge to make that finding, and the judge declines to do so. That also distinguishes this case from many other speedy trial cases, because in many speedy trial cases, that's the issue, whether there is good cause for the delay. Well, we know there's not here because the trial judge expressly declined to make that finding. And that was correct. The trial judge continued this trial because he didn't think it was fair to make people show up for jury service when social gatherings were prohibited. And he assumed that people in Crow Wing County would not follow the safety rules that were in place. He said that very repeatedly and expressly. And that's why he was continuing the trial. Those are not good cause reasons to deny someone a speedy trial.
So, Mr. Butler, if I can jump in, are you saying that we are not able to decide whether there was good cause in this case ourselves, or are you just making the point that here the district court judge declined to do so and we should find that persuasive or agree with that?
I don't think the court is prohibited from saying good cause, Your Honor, but I do think that the latter thing you said is true, that it's very instructive that the person sitting there who normally, in almost every speedy trial case I've ever seen, says, well, this is good cause for the delay, that's good cause for the delay. And then we come before this court and argue as to whether that's true or not. I don't believe I've ever seen a case where the trial judge declines to make that finding. And I think this court should be persuaded by that. The third thing I wanted to point out about speedy trial is that the defendant is presumed to be prejudiced by this delay. And there's been some back and forth about that recently, so I think it helps to return to first principles. In Barker versus Wingo, the United States Supreme Court invited states to set their own limits on what kind of delay would be considered excessive enough to trigger a speedy trial analysis. In Minnesota, that delay is 60 days. That's the delay that presumes prejudice. And in Mickle and Osorio and a host of other cases, the Minnesota Supreme Court has used that phrase. Prejudice is presumed. So the question here is not whether Mr. Lucas was able to marshal evidence that he was prejudiced by this delay. That would defeat the entire purpose of a presumption. The presumption is that he was prejudiced. And the question is whether the government, the state, can marshal evidence or did marshal evidence before the district court to rebut that presumption. The state here makes no argument that it did so. And that then brings us to the Doggett versus the United States language. And in Doggett, the United States Supreme Court is very clear that when the presumption of prejudice, this is a quote, the presumption of prejudice, albeit unspecified, is neither extenuated as by the defendant's acquiescence nor persuasively rebutted, the defendant is entitled to relief. End quote. That's at page 658 of Doggett. So the defendant, of course, didn't do anything to extend this prejudice. All he did from the day one, from the second court appearance on forward, was demand a speedy trial. He didn't ask for a continuance.
Mr. Butler, if I can jump in, I think when we're talking about prejudice and whether there's a, you know, who has to assert facts or come forward with, but doesn't it... isn't it the appellant's job when it comes to our general understanding of appellate review to explain how the outcome would be different? And perhaps you can jump to that argument in light of the other cases that had a hold or for which Mr. Lucas was in custody, and how can there be any other outcome if on these other cases there was a custody hold?
Sure. So two answers to that, Your Honor. First, of course, I'm going to say he's presumed prejudiced and he is prejudiced by this delay. But of course, no prejudice is required at all. So even if you decide that Mr. Lucas was not prejudiced by this speedy trial delay, the other three Barker factors clearly weigh in his favor, and the court can and should grant him relief on speedy trial grounds with or without prejudice.
I think that's where I wanted to press a little bit. Is there any case you're aware of where this court or the state Supreme Court has found under that fourth Barker factor there was no prejudice, and yet there still was a speedy trial violation? Or in practice, is that last factor essentially an independent reason by itself to find no violation?
Yeah, the closest I can think of off the top of my head, Your Honor, is Windisch, Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1999. There's no prejudice there. The Supreme Court reverses. I believe that may be technically a supervisory powers reversal, not a speedy trial reversal, but it's similar. And I think the court can look to Windisch for guidance. I would also say that if Your Honor's hypothesis is correct, that prejudice has become some sort of required factor, then perhaps the court needs to back off that a little bit, the courts in this state, because Barker, of course, is very clear that no prejudice is required. I would also say, actually, now off the top of my head, I thought of another one. State versus Griffin, a published decision from this court sometime around 2009. We were called published then, not precedential. In Griffin, the defendant was out of custody for the whole time, the entirety of the delay. And the court, when it reversed Ms. Griffin's speedy trial or conviction, reversed the conviction on speedy trial grounds, said no more than what I'm asking the court to say today, which is that prejudice is presumed and no evidence was presented to rebut that prejudice. And there, like I said, the defendant was out of custody. She was free to come and go almost as she pleased. She had some conditions of release, of course.
I'm having a difficult time understanding this prejudice argument. On the one hand, you're saying that prejudice is not a requirement, and then you're saying, but it's presumed. Well, if it's presumed, I guess that there is a requirement, or otherwise we wouldn't be talking about it. So help me understand these two seem to me contradictory positions.
Sure, Your Honor. I think the argument, the flow chart goes something like this. The fourth Barker factor weighs in the defendant's favor because prejudice is presumed. Full stop. Now, let's say the state marshals some evidence to overcome that presumption. Talk about, you know, maybe the defendant wasn't really that nervous or whatever. Somehow overcomes the presumption of prejudice. All right, or the presumption of prejudice. Okay, let's say the fourth Barker factor then weighs against the defendant in favor of the state. Well, the defendant still wins in this case because there are four factors. It's a balancing test. And on balance, the four factors weigh in favor of Mr. Lucas. So in other words, even if I'm wrong and Mr. Lucas wasn't prejudiced, we still would present to the court that his speedy trial rights were violated because the other three factors weigh in his favor.
Mr. Butler, if we could talk about another one of those factors, reason for the delay. What are you asking this court to decide? And I may have some follow-up for you.
Sure. The only thing I'm asking this court to decide is that the reasons for the delay weigh against the government. I'm not asking the court to decide whether it was the right thing or the wrong thing to do to continue the trial. That's not the inquiry. You know, you don't have to say the judge abused his discretion by continuing the trial. The second Barker factor asks, who is responsible for the delay, the defendant or the state? And clearly, in this case, it's the state. And then asks, to what extent is that delay weighed against the party responsible? And in this case, the delay should be weighed relatively heavily against the party responsible, the state, because the reasons the judge gave that were endorsed by the prosecutor at trial are not good cause reasons to delay a trial. They certainly weren't related to anything in this case specifically. The judge walked into court on November 30th and announced that there would not be a trial. He didn't hear arguments on the matter and was persuaded one way or the other.
What about the local concerns of a district court judge, and how much should this court defer to those concerns? I mean, here we had a pretty localized analysis of the conditions on the ground around the time of the trial. Is it appropriate for us to say, well, you know, we weren't there, but not good enough?
I think that's just the point, Your Honor. You don't have to say not good enough. All you have to say is weighs against the government. That's it. And that is just, that's not a value judgment question of the quality of the reasons. That is just saying which party bears the burden of the delay. And it certainly isn't the defendant. And so the answer, if it's not, it's a zero-sum game. If it's not the defendant, then it's the state. Again, if it's the Minnesota Supreme Court coming down with an order saying everyone stop, well then, okay, this court has said that is a neutral reason. But I don't know of any case where a judge made a decision to continue a trial based on something like this, some sort of facts. And the reviewing court said, well, anything other than this weighs against the state or weighs against the defendant if it's the defendant's fault. The defendant asked for continuance or fired his lawyer or something like that. And I also would come back to the good cause finding here. I think it's important that there was no good cause finding. I also think at least at one point the judge says, well, the defendant's in custody for something else anyway. But the Minnesota Supreme Court has said that doesn't matter. The speedy trial right isn't suspended because you're awaiting sentencing on another case. Maybe in some cases, the Supreme Court has talked about that the anxiety and prejudice stuff, it's harder to apply those when the defendant is in custody based on waiting for another trial. That's Windisch and Taylor, our cases about waiting for another trial, because even if you didn't go to trial on this one, you're still waiting for another trial. Mr. Lucas was in custody waiting for a sentencing. If he wasn't going to trial on this, they could start the sentencing the next day. So he wasn't, and that's a material difference from the other cases. The United States Supreme Court has said for years, and this is on cases cited in our brief on page 19 in footnote, note 5, that even a person in prison on an unrelated offense can suffer anxiety and concern from a delay of a trial. And so that, if a person in prison can suffer that kind of anxiety and concern, certainly a person in Mr. Lucas's position can suffer that kind of anxiety and concern. I have a minute and a half left, and I did want to touch on the expert testimony issue if the court doesn't have further questions on speedy trial. It's interesting. This expert has testified in a number of cases. This court's familiar with them. The state has cited them all. We acknowledge them. The difference here is this. The expert in this case did not just opine on behaviors of complainants. The expert spent a huge alleged behaviors of perpetrators, specifically male perpetrators. And the expert repeatedly drew this distinction between men who engage in acts of violence against their partners and women who engage in acts of violence against their partners. And basically, it never works.
I just want to talk about the scope of the testimony. Was there any objection to the scope? That this went beyond the bounds of what was permissible during the testimony itself?
There was no objection during the trial, Your Honor, but there was also no limitation in the ruling by the district court before the trial. The district court there was an objection before the trial, the matter was litigated, and the district court admitted the testimony carte blanche. And so under this court's precedent, I think that preserves the issue for appeal. And Mr. Lucas's attorney didn't have to object again during the trial to say, hang on, something has gone wrong. In my last 7 seconds, I just point the court to Vu. The decision from 2000, I think, is very similar to what happened here. And this court should do the same thing it did in Vu and reverse Mr. Lucas's conviction. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Butler. We'll turn to Mr. Hersey.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Scott Hersey. I'm a special assistant Crow Wing County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this appeal. I would point out that while the district court at the November 30th hearing did not make a good cause finding, the court pointed out when asked by the prosecutor if the court was going to do so, he said, well, I wasn't planning on that because we're not at the 60-day mark yet. But at that time, I could, is the way he phrased it. So the reason there wasn't a specific finding of good cause at that hearing is simply because they weren't at the 60-day mark. It's not that the judge didn't find good cause or couldn't find good cause. But I would point out that the judge at the December 28th hearing denied the motion to dismiss the case based on a violation of speedy trial rights and issued a fairly extensive written order that was filed on January 6th. And it's clear in that order that that was a good cause finding. The judge found that the primary cause of this delay was
Can I jump in and make clear which delay was that specified? What by a date range?
I believe the judge was talking about the continuance of the December 7th trial date in the January 6th order.
And if I could go back to that, the transcript for the hearing on November 30th, it seems maybe there's a disagreement as to kind of how that was presented. There is a request from the prosecutor for the district court to make a good cause finding. And Mr. Butler is correct that the district court says I wasn't intending to. Do you then point to some other part of the transcript where the district court says, there is good cause at this point, but I'm just not going to find it?
I don't think that's how the court phrased it. But as I read the transcript and as I understand it, the reason the judge was saying I wasn't intending to, meaning making a good cause finding, was we're not at the 60-day mark yet. And I think that is in that transcript.
Right.
And that's how I interpret that.
Page 20, lines 22 to 24, the court says, at that point in time, I could make a good cause at this point, but we're not even at the 60 days. That's what you're referring to?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm referring to. And I would point out that then the judge at the December 28th hearing and in its January 6th order said that the delay was due to safety concerns caused by the pandemic. And That's why there was no trial on December 7th. And it did go through and analyze the Barker factors. It said, because this was beyond the 60-day limit of Rule 11.09, it was presumptively prejudicial. And that in turn triggered analysis of the other factors under Barker. And the reasons were the governor's and the chief justice's orders made to protect Minnesotans, including defendants, jurors, and others from COVID. And that court specifically found that the delay was not due to the prosecution nor any legal maneuvering by either party. And it pointed out that the courtroom in Crow Wing County was a small courtroom without adequate spacing. And it went on to analyze prejudice in this case. It said there was no oppressive pretrial incarceration because Mr. Lucas was being held in custody on two felony cases pending sentencing, and there was no undue anxiety or concern also because of the fact that he was being held on those other cases. And it based that
on... Can I ask a quick question about those two? Because my recollection might be incorrect, but my recollection was that it wasn't simply a matter of pending sentencing, but there were also motions to withdraw from the pleas in those cases as well that were pending?
That's true. That's true. Those were pending as well. And he had a number of other cases that were pending as well. And I believe that the January 6th order listed a very good and detailed chronology of all the other crimes that had been committed by Mr. Lucas and for which he was charged and had proceedings pending and had orders outstanding. I believe he had an order outstanding of unconditional bail of $100,000 that covered all of the various cases that were pending. But I believe, if I recall correctly, that January 6th order, I think the judge based that determination of no oppressive pretrial incarceration, et cetera, on State versus Mickle. And it also specifically found that there was no showing made that the continuance from December 7th impaired the defendant's defense. And I would like to go back to Mr. Butler's argument about presumptive prejudice. And that does come from the discussion of the U.S. Supreme Court in the Doggett case. But I would point out that both as our courts have interpreted Doggett and as Doggett itself said, there they were talking about oppressive delay. And so it appears that there are two types of prejudice. One is there's actual prejudice proved by the facts of the case. And of course, the damage to the defense case is the most important of those. But there is presumptive prejudice. But Mr. Butler appears to argue that presumptive prejudice is all-encompassing and that covers everything. But as I read Doggett talks about excessive delay causing presumptive prejudice, aside from the specific facts of the case. And in Doggett, that was 8.5 years. That was a significant period of time. And in fact, if you go back to Barker, I don't remember the exact time frame, but I believe it was somewhere around 5 years because a co-defendant was tried numerous times, several times. They had either a hung jury or reversal there. So those were very excessive delay cases. And I'm submitting that in our type of situation, the presumed prejudice from Minnesota jurisprudence is basically a triggering factor. Unless it's excessive under Doggett, it's simply a triggering factor to go to the analysis of the other three factors.
Wasn't there a point in time when there was no Supreme Court prohibition on having a jury trial, but there was a procedural way of seeking the approval of the chief judge to have a trial? Is that right?
In this particular case, Judge, as of the November 20th order of the Chief Justice, there was a methodology by which an exception to the general rule of no in-person jury trials from November 30th to February 1st was authorized. But I would point out,
and the trial judge in this case declined to use that opportunity to seek the additional authority to have a trial. Isn't that right?
That's true. That is true, Judge.
Did the judge give a particular reason why?
I understood part of the reason was because they were not at the 60-day mark yet. And I know that there was not another
motion. What does that mean? You're not at the 60-day mark. You wait until 60 days has expired, and then the trial judge would go out and make that inquiry and try to get the case set.
I think that was part of the judge's rationale, but the judge also said it was difficult to maintain social distancing in the jury room.
Well, look, ultimately this case was tried. Was there anything changed that would make the time of trial not having the same difficulty?
I would say yes, Judge. And the reason for that is, as I mentioned in my brief.
Was that identified on the record? That now there's not a problem with social distancing? Now there's not a problem with the jurors? I missed it. I'm sorry.
I don't see that in the January 6th order. I don't see that is specifically referenced. But
so then
both
my question is there any reason why the trial judge didn't set this matter earlier than the January setting?
For that particular point, Judge, I would rely on what I argued in my brief. And as you will notice, both parties argued the general statistics of the COVID pandemic. And in my brief, I referenced the statistics that showed that the COVID cases were going up dramatically. And I believe that was even mentioned in the governor's order just before the Supreme Court order on November 20th, that the cases were peaking and skyrocketing in November and December, and they started to decrease again in January. That is a significant difference, and that, I believe, is something that caused the later judge to seek permission, obtain permission from the chief judge and from the chief justice to go ahead with the trial on January 11th.
And when did the ultimate trial judge make this request?
I believe that was listed in the January 6th order, and I can't remember the exact particular date of it, but it's listed exactly in that order, Judge.
But it's sometime in advance, sometime earlier than January 6th.
Yes, it would have been, yes, sometime just before January 6th.
And at the time this request was made, now the COVID was on the decline?
I believe it was. I believe it was based on the statistics put out by the Department of Health. And I've referenced that in my brief, and I believe that distinguishes the period there. I might also note that I didn't see anything in Justice Gilday's order that necessarily precluded a litigant, a defendant, from making the application directly to the chief judge. And I note that that was never done by the appellant in this particular case. And as long as appellant's counsel disclosed to the chief judge that the trial judge had not made such a finding, I think that would certainly have been the appropriate way to do it. It was not really the trial judge that could make the decision under Justice Gilday's order. It was the chief judge in consultation with Justice Gilday. And so that had to have been decided by the chief judge. And I see nowhere in the record that there was any effort by the appellant to make an application to the chief judge to obtain that permission.
Nor and by the state.
That's true. That's true. But it's the defendant who's making his claim that his speedy trial rights were violated by the fact that the trial started 28 days after the 60-day period under Rule 11.09. And I would submit that here, as the judge found in the January 6th order, there was no showing of specific prejudice in this particular case. In fact, a review of the trial transcript shows that there didn't appear to be any impairment of defendant's case, and there was no record made by the appellant that his defense, in fact, was impaired. The trial transcript shows that appellant's trial counsel thoroughly cross-examined each of the state's witnesses and did a very good job of it, but presented no evidence, and the defendant appellant himself chose not to testify. So there was no proven prejudice to his case. And in fact, the district court on the January 6th order found that there was no prejudice as well. And you are correct, Judge, that in the cases I cited, as Mr. Butler pointed out, those were cases during a time frame when any in-person jury trials were prohibited in this case occurred where there was a possibility of an exception to that. But I would submit that similar reasoning does apply. Here, we're talking about rising COVID cases starting in the summer and going through the fall all the way through November and December. We're talking about a situation where in the January 6th order, the judge found that they had a small courtroom without adequate spacing. The judge at the November 30th hearing found that there would be difficulty with social distancing going in and out of any jury room. And I would submit that the risks to the public and to defendants and to jurors were basically the same, whether you're talking December 7th or November 17th. But putting it off by another 28 days gave some breathing space. And while it's not clear from the January 6th order exactly what transpired in the consultation between the chief judge and the chief justice, they decided that at that point, an in-person jury trial could occur. I would briefly like to talk about the testimony of the expert witness, Scott Miller. And I would submit that that is a case where the standard of review is abuse of discretion. And as I pointed out, there were five prior cases where he gave almost identical testimony where this court has, in fact, upheld the convictions.
Did those cases involve substantial comment about the defendant or an accused party?
As I understand the description in each of those cases, Judge, what it sounded as if it was very similar, and I see no reason why Mr. Miller would be changing his testimony from those cases to this case when he's talking in generalities. And they gave kind of an overview of his testimony, but it sounded very similar to what was here. But I would quickly point out that you can't talk about a victim's behavior in domestic abuse in a vacuum. One has to talk about the interplay between both the abuser and the victim. And I would submit that that was not an abuse of discretion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hersey. Mr. Butler.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start by responding to Judge Klopaki's last question to counsel. The answer to that question, Judge Klopaki, is no. Mr. Miller, in those other trials, or at least it wasn't an issue in the appeal, did not testify substantially about the common behaviors of perpetrators of domestic abuse, particularly male perpetrators of domestic abuse, as opposed to female perpetrators of domestic abuse, at least those in opposite gender relationships. Mr. Miller drew some comparison, said females in the same gender relationships are just like men in male-female relationships. None of that came up in the other cases. And I can tell you that I'm the lawyer in one of them, a case called Eziobi, and I remember that case very well. And you can check the transcripts or the records in those cases. But the answer is no. I agree that, of course, nothing happens in a vacuum. Is the expert going to have to say something about the other party? Sure. But this testimony went far and above just mentioning that there's another two parties involved in a domestic situation. The expert talked extensively about what men do, what men think, and how men act. Gave specific examples of men versus women doing certain things. And then the state in closing use that testimony to bolster the complainant's testimony and to put the case in context that supported the state. The one thing I want to mention that I didn't get highlighted in the briefs, and that's my fault, is that this is a self-defense case. The judge instructs the jury that on self-defense. And so the question for the jury is not just, did Mr. Lucas hit the complainant with a board or whatever she said he hit him with. It's not just a quote-unquote he said, she said. The question for the jury is, were Mr. Lucas's actions reasonable in defense of himself or others? That's a very different question. And it's much more prejudicial to have an expert then come in and say, well, males who are involved in so-called domestic abuse are almost per se unreasonable, not only because of their behavior, but because of what the expert here called the difference in their intent. The expert said men intend to control their female partners. Men intend to terrorize their female partners. Women, on the other hand, do not, the expert said. Women, on the other hand, the phrase he used was all women who do violent acts against their partners are merely trying to get out of a relationship or act in self-defense. And that mattered here because there was evidence that the complainant in this case threw a very heavy flashlight at Mr. Lucas, and that was part of the back and forth that led to the incident that led to the charges. And so that's the reason I think the state brought up that testimony about what females do, is because they're trying to account for the complainant's undisputed actions. Undisputed, the complainant threw a flashlight at Mr. Lucas. She testified to that. So that answers that question. To Judge Klopaki's question about whether anything changed between November 30th and January when the trial was held, the answer to that question is also no. Nothing in the record anyway. Mr. Hersey refers a lot to COVID statistics. No one ever mentioned COVID statistics in this record as a reason to delay this trial, why it couldn't be held in early December or why it could be held in January. That's not part of this record. The order is interesting. It's in our brief. And if you look at the order, addendum page 6 in our brief, the judge just asks a guard, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, acknowledges in a footnote on page 6 that he did not have a transcript of the November 30th hearing or the December 8th hearing, which actually has nothing to do with this issue. He did not have a transcript of either hearing to determine exactly what was said or discussed, and there are no notes or court minutes for the undersigned judge to review. So in other words, when Judge Askegard in early January issued that order saying, well, the trial was continued because of COVID, he didn't know why the trial was continued. It seemed to have something to do with COVID, but he didn't know the details.
Mr. Butler, I know your time's expiring, so I'll try and keep you brief. What do you make of the discussion that there, you know, they had to have a jury questionnaire, and so once you figure out how many jurors were called in, and they knew how many strikes would then be used back in December, early December. What do you make of that discussion where it's pretty clear that there wouldn't be enough jurors to get through voir dire?
I think that's
jurors had called in saying they had COVID.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be good cause at that point?
Your Honor, that's a really interesting and important point, and that goes to the motion to supplement the record. The prosecutor in this case completely misstated the number of jury questionnaires that had been received. The prosecutor said they had received, I don't have the quote in front of me, it's all in our brief, about 20 or 22 questionnaires. That is not true. The supplemented record shows that over 40 questionnaires were received for the November sitting, and considerably more than that were received for a December sitting. And so this is a concern that at one point was expressed by the defense attorney was, well, the prosecutor here is just saying stuff. We have no idea what's actually going on, how many people have called in with COVID or anything else like that. And we still don't know that. And I'll accept that some potential jurors probably called in and said, I have COVID. But the numbers are the numbers. And the idea is actually one of the prosecutor's stated reasons for continuing the trial from December is they didn't have enough juror questionnaires to pick a jury is simply not true. And so to the extent the trial judge relied on that, I think it's clear that he did, that itself was an error as well. And we know that now from the supplemented record.
Okay. Are there other questions from my colleagues on the panel? I don't see any. Well, we will take the matter under advisement and issue a decision within the statutory timeframe. Thank you both very much.